Okay, we're beginning now tape two, and I'm talking with Norman Simo.
Yes.
And he came in 1938 from Albania when he was 9 years old.
Yeah.
And we're talking now about
the trip.
A very tumultuous bus trip.
Right,
leaving
right.
Albania.
That's right.
Okay, yeah. So go ahead.
So, all right, so now we arrive, we finally arrive in Tirana, which is the capital of Albania. And there's hotels there, but we don't have that much money. So fortunately, we have family. So we stayed with family. And the family had a car, believe it or not, in Tirana, the capital. So that came in very, very handy. They not only toured us of Albania, but we had to stay in Albania for something like 2 weeks. We had to get permission to leave Albania. And why are we leaving Albania? And why are two young boys leaving Albania? And why is this young girl, now that would be my aunt, she was 16, why is she leaving Albania? Why aren't just the old ladies, my mother and my grandmother, and we should stay, in other words. So,
what was a satisfactory answer to give for leaving Albania?
Well, the reason we left Albania, the satisfactory answer was that we're going to be together as a family, the mother, the father, and the grandfather, and the grandmother, and the brother. So the family is going to join together. And eventually we're going to make enough money, the whole family, and then return back to Albania. So that more or less, satisfied them. Except for one incident where they didn't really want to let my aunt go. So it took a bribe. We had a $5 gold piece. It took a bribe of that $5 gold piece to get them to release her.
Do you know why she was the one that they picked on?
I guess there was a why should she go?
Because she's not the immediate
the immediate family. But her grandmother, my grandmother, is her mother. So we had to kind of explain that. So that's how we finally got her to come over here. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. So finally, we went from Tirana, went to Durres, and from Durres we took a boat to cross the Adriatic to go to Italy. Then we went to Italy, and I thought that was a devastating trip. The Adriatic, I thought was a small sea, right? It would be nice and smooth. It was choppy, and forget it. I was seasick for 2 days. It took 2 days. Can you imagine that? It took 2 days to cross over to Italy. So we finally got to Naples. And then at Naples, it took another week before we could get out of, make the connections from Naples to get on to the boat. And then we finally, after another week in Naples, and that was an interesting city. It was the first time I ever saw a policeman in white uniform directing traffic in the middle of the... I said, my God, what is this? Can you imagine? My eyes were open for the first time. I saw all kinds of automobiles and buses and transportation and these policemen and soldiers. It was like, what is this?
Had you ever seen policemen in Albania?
No, never. I had never seen them. Once in a while, we see a soldier because there was a barracks close by, but we had never seen a policeman.
And you didn't have cars.
There were no cars to speak of. Nothing.
What else struck you about Naples? Can you think of it?
Yeah, in Naples, the people were like flies. I'm saying, my God, look at them. It was so crowded. I'm saying, wow, are there that many people in this world? So you can imagine my sight of New York City. Oh, my God. When we arrived in New York, I could see from the distance the automobiles. They were like little flies, jetting through. And I'm saying, what is that? And then these high-rise buildings, when I saw them, I'm saying, my God, look at the size of those buildings. How can they stand up? How come they're not falling down? Why are they up there? What's holding them up? The wind should be blowing them down. So you could, you know, the marvel, the engineering marvel that it happened. You know, it's unbelievable.
Well, wait, you said earlier that the name of the ship you came on is on the card that you donated to Ellis Island.
We need to find that, but
it was an Italian ship.
It was an Italian ship, and it came sailed out of Naples.
And do you happen to know precisely the date that you left?
It took about 2.5 weeks. We arrived here November 11th, so we probably left the middle of October. Yeah, probably the middle of October that we left. And those are the days when the seas are choppy. Oh, boy.
It was a choppy trip. Well, were you in steerage?
We were in second class.
Was that pleasant?
That was crowded. It was crowded. I never knew there was another third class. We were in second class, so I thought we were in heaven. I mean, you know, in comparison to what I had experienced, second class wasn't bad. There was good accommodations. Then we took, you know, being a kid, you can get away with going up. So we visited first class, and, I mean, you know, talk about plush. That was plush. We saw, I mean, luxury that you wouldn't believe. The tables were laden with food, and there was all kinds of plush chairs and furniture and rugs. I mean, you know, Oriental rugs, the most expensive that you could buy. Speak about luxury, and these beautiful big chandeliers. And you saw people in uniform that were handling and bringing drinks. And, you know, you'd see, wow, what is this? It was like another world. It was a different kind of a world. Well, you didn't have that in the second class. You know, we just had a little room, and it was like a crowded hotel, more or less.
And how about third class? Did you get a look at that?
We went down to the third class, and that was even more crowded than we were. That was kind of like, you know, speaking of cattle. That was where they pushed everybody together. They just had maybe bunk beds. You know, it was like five beds to one row. You know, and that was.
Well, this trip must have been a real eye-opener for a nine-year-old.
It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe the difference. Can you imagine seeing the Atlantic Ocean? You know, I never thought there was that much water in the world. And the waves, my God, at one time we had a storm. It was like, you know, everybody had to stay indoors. The water would just go right over the boat. I thought for sure we were gone. I said, this is it. Yeah. What a place to go.
What about your mother and grandmother? How were they faring on this?
My mother used to get seasick. My grandmother did all right. My brother, he had a ball. He didn't get seasick. As a matter of fact, I used to watch him. They would wet the deck, and they would make a slide on the deck, and they would run and slide with their shoes, you know. They were all these little kids. Kids, language is no barrier for kids. Kids and kids, they'll get along together. And they were sliding. I tried it. It wasn't for me, you know, because I used to get sick, and I'd be, you know, over the side, or, you know, or I'd be laying down. And it was a terrible trip for me.
Were there any examinations involved, either before you left or
on the ship? There was a quick examination on the ship to make sure that you were in good health. You know, you were good health going in, make sure that you were in good health going out. And the final examination was, of course, at Ellis Island. That was devastating.
Well, first tell me about when you came into the harbor. Did you see the Statue of Liberty?
Yes. Actually, it was the word came out. Guess what? The Statue of Liberty. You know. So next thing you know, I mean, it's like everybody. Can you That's thousands of people just running over. We thought the boat was going to capsize. Running over to the side to see this beautiful Statue of Liberty. All you could hear was the Statue of Liberty. You are now coming into freedom. This is the country where everybody is free. This is the country where opportunity, where gold. You could pick up gold in the street. You didn't have to work or anything. All you do is just go around. You wanted something to eat? Pick up some gold and go buy some. It was unbelievable, right? All these stories that you heard about. But when you saw that beautiful lady, when you saw that flame, it was unbelievable. It was like a relief, you know, like goosebumps came over you. Here you are coming into the land of opportunity. And finally, that it's over, you know? That freedom is now just around the corner. And there was the statue, there was the light to guide you into the harbor. Oh, it was unbelievable. And everybody goes, oh, the statue. Everybody, that's all they talked about. You know, the big rush was on. It was, was something. You know, and you could see some people were crying. I mean, it was wonderful, you know, tears of joy. It wasn't tears of, it was tears of joy. And you're saying, my God, you know, this is it. This is America. We're here. We finally made it. Especially after a bad trip on the ocean. You know, two and a half weeks is a long time to be out on that ocean. Yeah.
So then you saw New York City.
Yeah, you saw New York City, and you could also see Ellis Island. Yeah, and they said, well, we're going to go around. We're going to go in there. You know, what for? Well, you got to go over there first. They're going to check out, make sure. Yeah. And I had never seen my father. I had seen pictures of him. I knew what he looked like, but I had never met him. So I kind of like, you know, I knew my grandfather, but I didn't know my father. So I was kind of like, wow, you know, what is he like? What is this going to be, you know? And my grandfather used to tell my father, you should see, you know, because my father knew my my brother, because he had come over, you know, after my brother was born. And he had seen my brother, but he had never seen me. So he didn't know what I looked like, who I was, what I was like, and I didn't know him at all. Like you said, I was born, 9 years without a father. So it was like an anxious moment for all of us. It really was an anxious moment for all of us. And I say that, I'll tell you why. My mother got the hives. Can you imagine? So here we are in Ellis Island. And she's got the hives. So when she's being checked up, they didn't know what she had. They thought that she had brought something from Albania. So they had to kind of like took her. And we were separated. Oh, my God. Can you imagine what an experience that was? To be separated. Where are you going? What are you taking her? And we were crying and we were all, we didn't know what was happening. You know? There was nobody there. The language barrier was unbelievable. Really a scary moment. So we didn't know what was going to happen. Are we going to go back? Are they going to send my mother back? What's going to happen? Yeah?
So what did happen?
Finally, they kept her over, you know. They took her, and for about 3 hours, and they finally, she calmed down. The fear of the separation from us. This is what she told us afterwards. She said, the fear of the separation, she calmed down, and they went away. And then they brought her back, and we got the checkup, and I remember running all over the place. You know, we had met some other kids, and we were all running all over the place in Ellis Island, checking it over and seeing what it was like and looking at all the people, and you say, oh, my God, how can all these people be here? And then finally I met my father.
Where did you meet?
And my grandfather, they were outside waiting for us. We were released. What a sight.
What was it like?
Wow. Well, right away, I went to my grandfather. Yeah? And I hugged and I grabbed my grandfather. And then my grandfather said, well, this is your father. You know? And I looked. I didn't, you know, I didn't go right away. You know what I'm saying? Because I didn't know him, and I didn't know how he was going to react, how he was going to take to me. Yeah? So I looked and I said, "See, meaning how are you?" You know, and he said, "Mira, I did." And he says, "Come here." So then when he said that, then I went over, you know, and he gave me a hug and a kiss, and he welcomed me. And that was how I met my father. Yeah. And you know what happened? What else happened is we were going to take the train. They had reservations to take the train back to Worcester. That way there, we were taking our trunks and everything, you know. But someone else had come to pick up their family. They thought their family was going to be on the same boat that we were on. And they lived in Worcester. And their family wasn't on. But he had a car. So my father says, "Are you going back to Worcester?" He says, "Yeah. Well, we'll give you $5 if you take the whole family back. We'll all go with you." And he said, "I have to go back anyway. Come on." So we came to Worcester by car rather than the train, which delayed. I think that was a stupid mistake because it delayed all our, all our luggage. I mean, you know, we didn't have our luggage.
The luggage came on the train?
The luggage came on the train. Now, if we had stayed with the train, when we got off, we would have taken all our luggage, identified our luggage, getting it all, and then taking it with us. And you hire a taxi, and you take, or, you know, you get someone to meet you at the train station, or hire a cab. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. So
I wonder why they made that decision. Why do you think? Was it because of an automobile?
Because of the automobile, and rather than the train, to see the sights, to see different sights of America. Yeah.
What were the sights of America that impressed you right in the very beginning?
The very beginning was the I'm telling you, the automobiles. It was like little flies. And then I said, "Are those cars? I mean, are those automobiles? People own all those automobiles?" It was unbelievable. It was a new world for me. I mean, it was like coming out of the feudal times into the 20th century. And that was something. And then when New York, all those people, my God, thousands and thousands and thousands of people. I'm saying, where are these people going? Where are they coming from? What do they do here? Where do they live? How do they live? How do they make a living? How do they feed them? It was just unbelievable. You know? And then the skyscrapers, it was just something. Oh. And then a ferry. I'd never been on a ferry before. Taking a ferry over, you know, crossing. Wow. And then again, we saw the Statue of Liberty. Now, but this time we had a chance to really see it close. You know? So, I mean, talk about beauty. She really stood out like a golden sun, you know what I mean? At that point, it was unbelievable. Then we knew, right then and there, we knew that we were home, you know, in America. It was just something else.
What was it like for your mother and father to be reunited here?
That's probably one of the reasons she must have got knives. I mean, you know, after a long time. She hadn't seen him, what, in 9 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here it is for the first time. And you couldn't really get together because there were all of us. Yeah. But he took her aside and he gave her a little smack and a hug. And he welcomed her, you know. But it's really like being reintroduced, would you think about it? Because, you know, 9 years is a long, long lapse.
Yeah. Did he write? Did they write?
Oh, yeah, they communicate. Oh, yeah, they used to communicate. Yeah.
Do you remember, like, from the letters,
yeah,
what kinds of things he told about America?
Well, he used to say, "Will you come over here? You're not going to believe this big land that we have here, all the land." I mean, you know, when you compare America to Albania, it's like a little postage stamp, you know, on a carrier. So you're not gonna believe this country. You're not gonna believe what they have here and the opportunities that are available. And you're gonna see homes. I mean, you know, really all kinds of luxuries in these homes. And you're gonna have running water, toilets in the house. What? What do you mean toilets in the house? You mean there's no outhouse? Toilets in the house. Like we had a toilet, we had an outhouse, right? It was still within our own bounds. But then we had like a kitchen aside. The kitchen was not in the house. The kitchen was set aside. Now, we had running water, but it was just only for cooking. It was outside, though, in our own yard. We had the running water, but they never used that to drink in Albania. We used to go. Now, there was a faucet like 20 feet away from the house. No, you can't get the faucet there. You got to go by Shinkoli. That was the name of the church. There was a faucet up there. That water comes directly from the mountain. When we get, you know, those pitchers, you got to go and fill a pitcher up there because that's cold water. So, I mean, that was the difference. But in America, everybody's got running water, and you got hot water. What's hot water? Running hot water. I mean, you know, unbelievable. So these are some of the luxuries that they used to talk about, and some of the good things, food. I mean, you know, let's face it, in Albania, at times, if it was in season, you ate good. If it was not in season, you kind of like sacrificed, and you ate just what was available. And meat, we probably had meat maybe once a month, you know, if we were fortunate. So, because they weren't working. We didn't have any kind of business or anything over there. They depended upon the family from here to send the money to Albania.
You know. So when you, it must have been crowded, the car, the automobile that you...
Oh, yeah. But it was a big automobile. But he was the driver, and then it was my father, my grandfather, my grandmother, my aunt, my mother, myself, and my brother. So you're talking about a lot of people there, but it was one of those big cars.
Uh-huh. So now, was this your grandmother and grandfather who were married, or was it you?
My grandmother and my grandfather on my father's side. Okay, that was my father, his father, my father's father, and my father's mother.
Oh, so they were reunited too.
Yes, they were reunited also. But see, he had made several trips, my grandfather. So, I mean, you know, he was not really a stranger. I had seen him a couple of times, 3 or 4 times. So he came over, you know, he paid more visits. Whereas the boys would work and the father would, we'll send the father over back to Albania. They didn't come. My father came once. That's when I was born. You know, he left before I was born. He didn't even see me. He left like 3 months before I was born. So he really never saw me. He only through pictures. So
what saint died on the day you were born? What is your
Well,
name?
Unfortunately, I was not named after a saint. I was named after a general.
Was that the other thing?
That was the other thing. And when my godmother. Because I had a godmother, named me, right?
So it would be one person, whether it was a godmother
or a godfather. Yes. When she named me, they looked at her because she gave me the name of a general. I don't think they were too pleased with what she did. You know, they said, "What'd you give the name of a general for? What with all the saints?" With all the saints, I think Saint Seraphim was the one that I would have been attached to. She says, no, I'm the godmother. I get the name. That's it. And that was it.
Is this the aunt who came over with you?
No. This was someone else. This was an aunt of my grandfather. Unbelievable.
Wow. So You all were in the automobile, and you got to Worcester.
Right.
And then what?
Right. Okay, when we got to Worcester, now we all lived together. You know? All the families, my grandfather, my grandmother, my aunt, you know. So it was one big, happy family. My uncle, Otis, was working in Lowell at the time. So we hadn't seen him. Now, we still were waiting to see him. He hadn't come. Then after about a month, he finally got some time off, and he came in to see us. So that was a nice experience when he came. Then after he came, he decided to go back to Lowell for only a few months. Then he got a job in Worcester because he wanted to be with the family as well. Yeah.
So now, was your father working as a chef in Worcester at
the
time?
Yes, he was working as a chef. He had worked in TNT Grill and the Coronado Hotel, and he'd worked in a few other places. And then finally, he got a job at Cosgrove's Chop House. He stayed there a few years. And then he got into the New Yorker restaurant, and then he went back to Cosgrove's Chop House, and then the New Yorker restaurant.
Where was the New Yorker?
It was right on Main Street. Right on Main Street. The owner said to my father, he said, look, because my father was thinking of leaving again, you know. He said, look, why don't we do this? Well, let's become partners. I don't want any money from you. We'll become partners. We'll split the profits 50-50. You just be the chef. You be the chef. And then I'll run everything else. There was a bar room there. It was a high-class restaurant, you know, really high class. And he says, no, I don't want to be a partner. I don't know why. He didn't want to be a partner. But he says, give me a salary. The guy says, okay. I'll tell you how fair he was. He says, not only I'll give you a salary, but at the end of the year, I'll give you a profit from the shares. So he did that, and he did quite well. And
who was the man who was the owner of the New Yorker who gave your father that offer?
Arthur. Because then he had an ice cream. Then he opened Arthur Smith. And then he opened. He left, because my father left. He went to Boston and started his own business there. And that didn't work out anyway. But he left. And then Arthur Smith sold out and opened up the Smithfield ice cream business. Unbelievable. Yeah? Unbelievable.
That would be quite a person to be partners
with. You're not kidding. That's right. He could have, I don't know. He didn't want to take a chance, I guess. Yeah, for some reason or another.
So what did you do? Did you start in school soon after?
Yes, soon after that, because then they registered in school. As a matter of fact, we started right after Christmas vacation. We waited until the Christmas vacation. We got settled in everything else. And then I started school, and then they put me in the first grade because I didn't know the language. And I said to myself, I've got to learn this language. This is ridiculous to be in with these little kids. I mean, I'm 9 years old, and you're talking about six-year-olds. So the first thing, I made up my mind right then and there that I would learn the language as quickly as possible, which I did. And then I advanced, a couple of grades.
Can you think of anything that you did to help yourself learn the language more quickly?
I just made sure that I hung around with these American boys, and I said, talk to me, you know, tell me different things. And then this Jonesy fella that knew Albanian, well, what does this mean? Then I would ask all kinds of questions from people. Well, tell me, you know, what, you know, I would say it in Albanian, and I'd say, well, what is this to my father, you know, my grandfather, what is this? You know, and he would, then this is how I learned. You know? And I just kept learning and hanging around with the kids in the neighborhood.
So in six months,
I was pretty good.
Yeah. So then what? Did you advance in the
Yeah, then I advanced. Then I advanced a couple of grades. Yeah, you know? But I still didn't fully advance. You know? Because once you get established in high school, junior high and high school, then you go through the process. So, but I advanced enough to, you know, almost catch up with my years. Mm-hmm. So then I went through junior high, and then went through high school.
So did your mother, your grandmother, your grandfather, your father, did they have certain traditions that they tried to keep alive in this country?
Yes, they always try to keep, the holidays, of course. You know, the Christian holidays, they maintain them. We still maintain that New Year's celebration with the feast and everything else. Christmas, naturally, Christmas was another thing. And Easter. Easter is one of the biggest holidays that we have. And always, Easter time, we would go out and got to get a new suit. That was the once a year, you dressed for Easter. That was the big thing. Everybody had a new outfit for Easter.
And it was Christmas celebrated the same way that it is here, or was there any variation?
No, Christmas was different. There was no no exchanging of the gifts as we have it here. It was a family celebration, and it was a church celebration. And the only thing they exchanged was like before that they used to have the Carnavale. You know, they would make like little cookies and stuff of that nature, and sweets. And they would exchange, you know, would invite people to the house if they came in. Then they would give them the sweets. So that was it was a religious, more or less the religious holiday. But Easter was the biggest holiday. That was celebrated for weeks, with the Lent and so forth, and you would fast and anticipation for receiving communion, and then you would go to church, and everybody would look at the new, what kind of outfit did he have on, what kind of a suit did they buy this year, So it was something to look forward to.
Well, actually, you had most of your immediate family here then.
Yes.
So
yes.
Did anybody in the family have regrets about coming here?
I had regrets about coming here. Well, I left my friends there. You know, I had established some close relationship. Well, not only relatives. You know, the boys that got killed by the Nazis. And, you know, we were all very close. And I really didn't want to come. I cried like a baby. I didn't want to come. I didn't want to leave all that. But then, what do? You have the family. You're attached to the family. You can't not go with the family. So it was like, you know, speaking about mixed emotions, that was really it. And then I had a dog. Yeah? Can you imagine leaving your dog? How can you leave your dog?
When you're 9 years old.
Yeah, when you're nine, it's like you know, it's part of you, right? Part of the family. So I had to leave that.
And what another, was your dog's name?
It was a mongrel. It was a mongrel, but he was a vicious dog. He wouldn't let anybody, a stranger, in the yard. You know, we had to muzzle him because he would bite any strangers. What was his name? Oh, I can't remember.
Did you have
I can't
him from
recall.
A puppy?
Yes, we had him from a puppy. And then you know what happened when. Before we came, someone had given me a half a lick, a coin. And you know that room, that parlor? Well, I dropped it near the fireplace, and there was a crack in the floor. And it fell in a crack. And I couldn't get that coin out to save myself. And I tried everything to get it out. When I went back to Albania in 1984, I wanted to see that room. Unfortunately, they had divided the house into two
apartments.
Yeah, so there was another family that owned it and lived there, and I couldn't get in there. I wanted to see if that coin was still there.
You could see it, but you couldn't get it.
I couldn't get it. I'm still going to go back one of these years and see if I can get back in there. It would be curious. I wonder if it's still there. Unbelievable.
So did you feel that way after you arrived here?
Oh no! After we arrived here, you know, with the family, then I made new friends, and we became established, and then the war came, and then our thoughts were for different reasons, you know, and that's when we said thank God, you know, because we escaped what 5 months? 5 months we would have been locked in, and naturally we would have been in the army there and fighting the Nazis, and God knows what would have happened.
So, when you got out of school, you went through high school?
Yes.
And then
yes.
When you got out, what did you do?
I graduated from high school, and I had a job at the same time. Well, I worked, even when I came over here, 11 years old, I started selling newspapers. I sold the Evening Gazette, and I sold, in the night, it was the Daily Record, so I sold the Afternoon Gazette and the Evening Paper. And then when I became about 14, I got a job in a Jewish delicatessen. This is a beauty. So I worked for these Jewish people in this Jewish delicatessen, right? And they started teaching me a little Yiddish. So I learned a little Yiddish. And he would have me make the coleslaw and the half-sour pickles. One of my jobs was to make the half-sour pickles. Now, the half-sour pickles, we used to make it in barrels underneath, you know, in the cellar of the delicatessen. So all the time, the owner would be saying, "How's it going down there, Norman?" I say, "Fine, you know, I'm making the half-sour pickles." 2 minutes later, "You're doing all right. Everything is good. Everything, there's no problem." You know, a couple of minutes later, "How's it going? I mean, everything fine there? How's the mix?" "Oh, it's great." After a while, I, you know, when I left, I said to him, "How come you kept, you know, calling me? Make sure it was all right." He said, "If I didn't call you, how do I know you're not eating my half-sour pickles?"
So you did that.
So I was still around 14 years old. And then I left the delicatessen. I got a job in a Jewish meat market. Ben Cohen. Ben Cohen's market. And there was a competitor, Mindix, just a little ways off. Yeah. So he'd say to me, "Go over to Mindix and see what his prices are like. What is he selling his hamburger for?" So take off your apron. I don't want him to see you.
As if he wouldn't know.
I mean, they knew who I was. My friends used to work at Mindix Meat Market. So we would exchange back and forth, see what the prices are. It was funny. It was really funny. Then Cohen sold to Barney and another fellow. He sold the market to them. And they started training me, you know, and I started learning, becoming a butcher. Yeah, and they said to me, "Come on, stay here," you know. But I said, "No, I want to go to school. I wanted to be a lawyer." I said, no, stay here, stay here. No, I don't want to learn the butcher business. Well, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. I said, "Thanks, but no." And some of the Jewish customers, like we had some very prominent customers, I would cut up the chickens and I would clean them and so forth. And they said to me, "My God, those hands, you should be a surgeon." You know, because I do all the parts of the chickens and so on. Then they would say, "Save me some chicken fat." Put aside some chicken fat. Then they would bring me some nice goodies, you know, apple strudel and some pastries as a reward. It was unbelievable.
So when you graduated from high school, then did you get a full-time job as a
teacher? Then after, when I was in high school, I was junior in high school, I got a job at the bakery, Table Talk Pastry Company. Yeah, so I worked in there doing all kinds of odd jobs, and I finally landed in the shipping department. And I was a good worker. I was an excellent worker. But then I wanted to go to school. So he said to me, "You know, you'll have a job here anytime you want." You know? I said, "Well, thanks a lot." But then I said, no, I'm going to go to school. So I graduated from high school, and then I went to BU, Boston University. So I started, and then the war came, Korean War. So I, so I decided to leave and join the Army. Then I got out of the Army, and I went back to school for a little bit, back to BU, and then I got out again. I got married, and then went back after I got married. Excuse me. I got my job back in the bakery, and so they put me in the shipping department, and they made me a supervisor in the shipping department. But I really wasn't happy, and I wasn't satisfied. I said, "That's not for me." Yeah, somehow there was more to that, you know, more to life than just that. Mm-hmm. And then when Kennedy became president, he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." And that made a deep, deep impression in my mind. And I said, "My God, this, I got to do something else." What, you know, I started looking at myself and looking at my accomplishments and where I'm at and what I'm doing. And I got two young kids. And I said, "There's got to be more." So, you know, being in the bakery, in the shipping room, we still had a union. A job came up in the morning. Now, I had to take a cut in pay of a couple of $1,000s to take this job because I wanted to go to school nights. So I talked to the wife. I said, "Look, I said, I'm really not happy doing what I'm doing. And I can't see this the rest of my life. I've got to do something more. So I said, I'm going to take that job and go to school nights and go into education teaching. She said, okay. So we didn't do it just arbitrarily. We figured out how much pay we were going to get, and I knew I wasn't going to get any overtime because they were angry that I was leaving the supervisor's job, you know, to take a morning job. So I took that job anyway, and I started going to school nights. And within 4 years, I got my bachelor's degree, and then I went into education, you know, became a guidance counselor. And then I got my master's degree. Then I continued after that, and I got my certificate of advanced graduate studies in social and rehabilitation counseling. So I got 3 degrees out of it, and I continued. That's what I'm doing now. I'm a guidance counselor and in a rehab as well.
You know, so did that fulfill you in the way that you had hoped?
The money isn't there.
Right, I know.
But there are, right, I should tell you, right? But there are intrinsic rewards. Then I was satisfied that I was helping the younger generation. I was making a better place for some kids for a brighter and a better future for the country and for those kids. So that's kind of like, you know, more or less fulfilled the need that I had.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, your wife, how did you meet her?
Oh, wow, that was... I had gotten out of the service. Actually, she had spotted me. Yeah. I thought I caught her, but she let me catch her. I found out later on. I'd gotten out of the service. I wasn't discharged yet, so I'd gone to church in my uniform, and she saw that, and she said, that was it. She knew. That was it. She was after me. She knew I was going to school. She had worked at Paul Revere. And now Paul Revere is located in Worcester on Chestnut Street. She would come down. She would run down, knew what time I was coming home, run down into the corner of Main Street and Front Street and wait until she spotted me. And then she would walk, making sure that I saw her with her girlfriend. Because we lived close to each other, yeah. So then I said hi, you know, and we started walking together. And one time the girlfriend said, "Well, he's calling you." She says, "Let him call. I'm gonna wait till he catches up." She says, "Yeah, but you might lose him. You might lose him." And the girlfriend said, "You might lose him." And my wife says, no, I won't lose him. He's going to be there. I got him caught." So she trapped me. You know what I mean? So she knew what she was doing. She said, "That's for me." She caught me then, and she had set this web that I was not aware of, and she nailed me right away, you know?
Should we stop for a second? Yeah, let me just... Okay, we're resuming now after just discussing the new Eastern Orthodox, nursing home is going to be.
Well, we're in the process now. We just received our HUD funding, and it's just being built now. It's going to be a 113-bed nursing home, and this is a combined effort of the Eastern Orthodox churches in central Massachusetts. There are 12 churches involved, and there are different ethnicity. This is the first time this has happened in America. There's the Greek, the Albanian, the Syrian, the Romanian, the Russian. All these faiths have come together. And, of course, we also celebrate once a year a Divine Liturgy, Sunday of Orthodoxy. We've had it at Mechanics Hall for a number of years. And now we're not only combining, but we're doing this nursing home as one body.
You know? Now, how are you involved in this?
Well, I'm one of the founders, and I was president of the Council of Eastern Orthodox Churches at the time of its inception, and I'm the one that picked the two chairmen now, and the president of the Holy Trinity Management Corporation. And I'm still on the board of directors. So I'm, you know, I'm one of the original members of the board. And we're going to see this thing through.
Well, let's get back. Tell me your okay. wife's name and maiden yeah. name.
My wife's name is Gloria. Her maiden name is Treska. Gloria Treska.
How do you spell her?
Treska. Treska. And
is she Albanian?
She's Albanian. She's Albanian.
Was she? But she was born here?
She was born here, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, she was born here.
And do you have children?
Yes, I have two daughters. Barbara, who's the oldest. Barbara is now... married, she was born in 1957. She has no children. She has a dog, and she says to me, "That's your grandson." I said, "You give me a dog for a grandson?"
But
I know it. I know it. He's a chow.
What's her married name?
Her married name is Pate, P-A-T-E. Her husband is a professional golfer. As a matter of fact, he just won, thank God, he just won a tournament out in the Dakotas. He came in first place, and that was a sigh of relief to do that.
But you have a daughter.
And Barbara is working. She's following her father's footsteps, I guess, working for a nonprofit organization. She's a director of the Mobile, Alabama Area American Cancer Society. And Denise is living in Auburn, Massachusetts. She's married to Peter, and Peter Latino, and he has, or they have, two grandchildren. So I have two grandsons. The oldest is 6 years old, Andrew, and the youngest is Paul. He'll be two in September. So, and she's in the nursing profession.
And she, well, tell me what you're most proud of that you've done in your life.
Well, hopefully, I've done a number of things. I was a boxer, and I'm a tortured reader in the church, and a chanter, and I've taught Sunday school, and I've done many things. I work with the poor, and I work with the destitute, and I work with the drugs for rehabilitation, and also in education, teaching how to say no, teaching students how to say no to drugs. We have an ongoing program where we teach the high school kids to go down to the seventh grade and to teach all the seventh graders how to say no to drugs and kind of like give them some information as to what drugs can do. I guess, what am I most proud of? I guess the fact that I've gotten as far as I have with my education, you know, all the obstacles that I had facing. I mean, you know, I've got two young kids working, going to school nights, getting my degrees, and then finally changing at my age. I was 39 when I went into education. I mean, can you imagine changing careers at the age of 39 and accomplishing the things that I did? I think that's part of the things that I'm proud of. And I've always received, I think I've received a lot from being in the United States. And I've been grateful for that, and I've always tried to give something back, because, you know, God only knows what would have happened if the doors were not open for me in this country. So I've always tried to give something back to the country.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what part of you, if you can talk about it that way, is Albanian, and what is American, or how has being Albanian in America?
We have a close knit group here through the church. We have an Albanian church, although it's open to everybody. You know, all Orthodox. Even the liturgy is done in English primarily, but we kind of like gather as Albanians, and we've built a home for the elderly. We've built a brand new church. And we're planning to do other things. So we've kind of like kept our ethnicity. Every other year we have a huge festival where anywhere from 40 to 50,000 people attend. We just got through in June having one. And a lot of Albanians come, and they point to Worcester as being like the center of the Albanian community. So we've maintained our ethnicity at the same time being part of the culture of America. Now, it's like I stated earlier, it's like a ceramic. You know, all nationalities put something on that mosaic, so to speak, and become a part of the total picture of what America is. So that's part of my contribution.
What is it? This is, I'm not sure this is an answerable question, but what is it about having that, preserving and maintaining that ethnic connection that gives you back, or what does it give you back that you have as an Albanian?
Okay, that's a good question. But, you know, there's a richness in the culture. There's a richness in all cultures. And unfortunately, a lot of this we've lost in America because we've tried to become a melting pot. Rather than become a melting pot, why can't we become a mosaic? Maintain some of our old background, old ethnicity, and then give this to America and let this become part of America. You know, even though, you know, it's part of a past, it could still be part of the future and part of the present, and maintain some of that ethnicity so that we kind of like understand each other a little better. You know, we have to know where we came from, who we were, and where we are, and where we're going. If we don't know that, then we lose something. So I don't know if that's an answer, but it kind of gives you an idea that we're all part of something, and we all belong to something. And why lose the richness of another culture if it'll still, it's not going to hurt anybody, but it could help. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's an answer, but...
Yeah. Well, what do you, you're among the youngest people I have a chance to interview. So tell me, what do you see for your future?
Okay, I'll be retiring soon, and I have different hobbies. Gardening is one of my hobbies. Photography is another one of my hobbies. The church is part of my life. The community is part of my life. So, I mean, even though I'm going to be retiring from my position as a guidance counselor in education, I'm still going to make a contribution to the American life and to the church and to the community. You know, I've been president of a number of different organizations, including the Council of Eastern Orthodox Churches, and I was president of the Basketball League, and that included many, many churches, Protestant and Catholic and what have you. We were all part of that. I founded not only a nursing home, I was part of the Homes for the Elderly and the credit union. I've made several contributions to education. I brought in one concept of pupils teaching pupils. I brought in different other things, like for the teaching of the gifted individuals. So hopefully I can contribute, I can continue to contribute towards making this a better life and a better place for the future.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you can think of? We actually have a few more minutes. I thought we were at the end, but is there anything else that you can think of that maybe came to mind over the time we were talking that you didn't have a chance to say? Or
thinking back about Ellis Island, I went back for a visit. And it kind of like it wasn't what I what I'd seen, what I had previously experienced, but I'm glad that they're bringing it back and they're restoring it, and I hope they'll restore the hospitals, because I think that whole complex should be full and complete, because it's a tribute to not only our country but to all the people that arrived here through those doors. And even those that are arriving now, I think they should all go and visit and see what it was like and see what the people that came here what they faced, and check the similarities, because there's no difference coming in now and when they came in now, when they came in then. The fears are still there, the anguish is still there, the wonder is still there, and futuristic look, and the wishes are still there, the dreams to fulfill, and the place to be that I can do things here. This is America. This is freedom. And you can taste it through Ellis Island, coming in there and looking back and thinking, wow, look at all the, we're talking about millions of people that came through and made a contribution that is America today. And I think that's the key to America, that we all have to make a contribution. We have to give. And unfortunately, we have some individuals today that are just take. And that's sad, because if we all give, and we give generously of ourselves, and give in a good way, this country has no limits as to what it can do and what we can accomplish in the future. And believe me, I mean no limits, because the future can be so bright and so beautiful for all, for everyone to enjoy and to appreciate, that I hope that someday we'll come to that realization, that only through understanding, only through love, only through appreciation of another individual can we accomplish this, not through hatred, not through fear, not through bullying, not through forces of evil. I guess that's about all I can really think of.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you.
I want to thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Wonderful interview. And I've been talking with Norman Simo, and you've given a really good idea of who you are, where you came from, and you've certainly given a rich contribution to this country.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you. This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service. It's August 9th, 1993, and I'm signing off.